Hello and welcome to Readings from Reason Magazine, issue April 2026, read to you by Steve Malisi. The Reflections is performative nonsense. During my younger days as a soccer dad, I got to watch the variety of ways that people handled the inevitable wins and losses. The trophy my daughter won after a big championship game is packed in a box somewhere in the garage, but the memories remain. Life is about more than winning. And indeed, most people involved in the games were good sports. But I remember some teams for which winning was everything. Their players would punch, kick, and trip our players whenever the referees weren't looking. The coaches constantly intimidated the refs. What's the likelihood that one's team is right on every single call? Not high, but these competitors never conceded anything. That experience reminds me of the modern Republican approach to elections. Under Donald Trump's leadership, the GOP's outlook is simple. Every election they win is a reflection of the will of the people. Every election they lose is rigged. The president never conceded the 2020 election, nor apologized for the January 6th Capitol attack. That was the result of angry partisans taking seriously Trump's bogus election fraud claims. Trump continues to push the tiresome rigged election narrative, even though he failed to win the dozens of court cases making such claims. Lately, Republicans aren't doing well at the polls. A Democrat just won a statehouse victory to represent the Florida district that includes Mar-a-Lago. She's the 30th Democrat since 2025 to flip a seat in a heavily Republican district. That's not surprising. The party out of power often does well in special elections and midterms. Republicans have pushed an unusually divisive agenda. Inflation is high, gas prices are soaring, ICE raids are frightening, and the president has launched a Middle East war. So yeah, there's going to be electoral pushback. Instead of moderating their policies or engaging in normal soul-searching, Republicans are doubling down and trying to nationalize elections by promoting something called the Save America Act. Save, as in Safeguard American Voter Eligibility. It would impose draconian voter identification requirements. The bill would require voters to provide a birth certificate or passport for registration, with the potential for disenfranchising vast numbers of voters, as many Americans don't have a passport and can no longer find their birth certificate. When Congress required a real ID for traveling, it provided years for Americans to comply. This legislation would take effect before the midterms. It's also a red herring. One can always find examples of illegal voting in a nation with 340 million people. But there's no evidence of widespread voting by non-citizens. Even a major MAGA-aligned think tank can only find a tiny number of incidents. Ironically, some of the most prominent illegal vote examples involve Republicans. There is no voting crisis that demands federal intervention. The legislation also takes aim at mail-in voting, which is ironic given that Trump himself used that system to cast his vote in Florida. Again, there's no evidence that vote by mail is any less secure than traditional in-person voting systems. Given the bill's iffy chances of passage, Republicans are cynically trying to build a case to challenge an election they believe they are going to lose. They'll blame losses on Congress's failure to fix a supposedly broken election system. It's politics as performance art. But if it does pass, it could lead to serious voter suppression. Our Constitution, you know, the document the Republicans continually attack, gives state legislatures the primary power to determine the election ground rules, although it does provide Congress with a role. There's certainly no role for presidential executive orders, as the president prefers. As the Institute for Responsive Government notes, the nation's decentralized election system also makes federal takeover impractical. The current process, run by local civil servants, is designed to make it harder for fraudsters and partisans to engage in shenanigans. Conservatives used to understand that federalism is one of the core founding principles that protects our freedoms, but not anymore. Of course, Democrats have in the past also tried to nationalize elections, with one onerous example occurring during the Biden administration. I grew up in Philadelphia, which is known for the election antics of its Democratic political machine. But the answer isn't for Republicans to one-up those efforts with their own election-rigging measures. Unfortunately, we've reached a situation best described by the New America Group. When two-party competition becomes an existential zero-sum contest over the rules of the game itself, the incentive shifts from persuading voters to controlling the machinery of voting. I have no real problem with voter ID if it boosts Americans' confidence in elections, but this measure would erode trust in the process. Trump has been disturbingly clear that this isn't about creating better elections. He's trying to control the voting machinery to achieve his desired results. Like with soccer, playing dirty only undermines the sanctity of the game. In democracies, sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. But if the GOP succeeds with its Trump-inspired dirty tricks, then we're all at risk of losing our democracy. Pam Bondi's loyalty to Trump wasn't enough to save her job. President Donald Trump announced Thursday that he is replacing Pam Bondi as U.S. Attorney General. Pam Bondi is a great American patriot and a loyal friend who faithfully served as my Attorney General over the past year, he wrote on Truth Social. He added that she would be transitioning to a much-needed and important new job in the private sector to be announced at a date in the near future. And Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche would take over as acting Attorney General. Despite Trump's kind words and assurance that we love Pam, Bondi has been fired, as news outlets reported was imminent. Bondi ultimately became the face of a persistent scandal about the government's files on deceased financier and sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. And though she was one of Trump's most vocal supporters, it wasn't enough to keep her job. As the nation's highest law enforcement officer, Bondi was a vociferous booster of Trump's agenda. During a televised cabinet meeting in May 2025, Bondi sang the president's praises to the cameras, bragging that in just his first few weeks back in office, Department of Justice seizures of illicit fentanyl had saved 258 million lives. The claim was ludicrous, seemingly assuming all seized fentanyl would otherwise have been divided equally among 258 million people with no opioid tolerance, who would each take the entire dose at once. But it served the purpose of fulsomely defending her boss and pursuing his priorities, which Bondi did throughout her tenure in office. While nobody would ever confuse government attorneys with saints, Bondi's DOJ gained a reputation for pursuing Trump's personal grievances above all else. With Bondi at the helm, DOJ attorneys pursued indictments against Trump and Trump's enemies, and those who didn't were quickly replaced with less qualified toadies. When Trump tried to circumvent federal law that kept him from installing U.S. attorneys in a long-term capacity without Senate confirmation, Bondi went along, firing the legal replacements so Trump could reappoint his picks. That level of disdain apparently carried over into the courtroom. The arguments that are being made by the Department of Justice attorneys under Pam Bondi are contemptuous, former Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge J. Michael Luttig said in October. Not just of the Constitution and the rule of law, but contemptuous of the federal courts, and even, if not especially, contemptuous of individual judges that are hearing the cases. Former U.S. District Court Judge Nancy Gertner added, "It's not just an issue of the arguments they're making. They're lying. They are misrepresenting things." But ultimately, it was Epstein that Bondi's career apparently couldn't survive. Epstein died in custody in 2019, and conspiracy theories have persisted ever since. On the campaign trail, Trump suggested he would release federal documents on Epstein's case, including a long-rumored client list. In February 2025, when Fox News asked about releasing the list of Jeffrey Epstein's clients, Bondi replied, "It's sitting on my desk right now to review." The DOJ later walked back Bondi's comments in July when it announced there was no Epstein client list. She was saying the entirety of all of the paperwork, all of the paper in relation to Jeffrey Epstein's crimes, not a particular client list, explained White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt. Bondi couldn't escape that unforced error. In subsequent congressional hearings, both Democrats and Republicans excoriated her for her apparent lack of transparency, and Bondi never quite came up with an acceptable answer. Testifying before the House in February, she tried to deflect Democrats' questions about the Epstein files by perplexingly pointing to the stock market. The Dow is over 50,000 right now, and the Nasdaq is smashing records, she says. That's what we should be talking about. Ultimately, this was not enough for her to keep her job. Trump had grown more and more frustrated with Bondi, one person familiar with White House deliberations said, adding that while he likes her as a person, he doesn't think she executed on his vision in the way that he wanted, reported NBC News. Since the Jeffrey Epstein files saga, Bondi had struggled to regain her footing with the president and deliver wins. Alabama birthing center regulations are nearly impossible to comply with. State Supreme Court could intervene. The Alabama Supreme Court could soon hear a case to determine the future of birthing centers in the state. In 2023, the Alabama Department of Public Health, ADPH, proposed setting strict requirements on the state's birthing centers. By regulating them as hospitals, the rule would require these centers to have a physician or consultant physician on staff, as well as a registered nurse and board-certified midwife. Birthing centers would also have to be within a 30-minute drive of a hospital. The rule was quickly challenged by a group of Alabama birthing centers represented by the American Civil Liberties Union. The plaintiffs argued that the rule created a de facto ban on birthing centers in the state because the ADPH refused to issue new licenses and violated their constitutional rights, as well as the rights of their patients. The suit also argued that the ADPH exceeded its statutory authority in making the rule. Under Alabama law, the agency is allowed to regulate general and specialized hospitals, rehab facilities, and abortion and reproductive centers, among others. It makes no mention of birthing centers. Any ambiguity on the question seemed to have been settled in 2017. That year, the legislature authorized certified midwives to attend home births independently and did not authorize ADPH to license or regulate that care, which involves the same midwifery care and patient populations as freestanding birthing centers, says the ACLU. In a 2023 complaint filed before an Alabama circuit court, the plaintiffs provided several practical issues with the ADPH's rules. One birthing center in rural Sumter County would have to close or relocate because it is 12 miles farther from the closest hospital-based labor and delivery care than permitted under the proposed regulations. Another center would have to undergo costly and extensive renovations to comply with the new rule. As Victoria Tice, a doula in Huntsville, recently told WSFA 12 News, the rules would require birthing centers to meet standards that do not reflect how birthing centers function. For example, she says, the width of doorways for hospital beds to fit through when hospital beds don't exist in birthing centers, and width of hallways and specific equipment that is not necessary to attend low-intervention physiological birth. The circuit court sided with the plaintiffs in 2025 and struck down the rule, which the court said was beyond the scope of ADPH's statutory authority to license and regulate hospitals. However, in January 2026, an appeals court reversed this decision and allowed the ADPH rule to stand. Now, the group is appealing this decision to the state's high court. If the Alabama Supreme Court decides to hear this case and sets aside the appellate decision, it would permanently protect the ability of freestanding birth centers across the state to continue providing essential midwifery care to their communities, said the ACLU in a recent press release. If the state Supreme Court sides with the ADPH, however, Alabamians can expect birthing center services to get more expensive and their care more sparse, which would be devastating for the nearly 60% of Alabama counties that lack any hospital-based obstetrical care. It shouldn't be this hard to give birth safely in the state of Alabama, and it doesn't have to, Whitney White, the ACLU's lead counsel on the case, told WSFA 12 News. Satanic Temple wins legal fight over Ten Commandments Monument in Arkansas. The Satanic Temple scored a legal victory on Tuesday when a federal judge ruled that Arkansas must remove a Ten Commandments monument from its state capital. The ruling comes after a nearly decade-long battle over the religious display on government grounds. In 2017, the Arkansas Capitol erected the privately donated monument after the state's legislature passed the Ten Commandments Monument Display Act, which authorized the installation. In response to the religious display, which was originally destroyed by a man unaffiliated with the Satanic Temple and installed again in 2018, the Satanic Temple offered to install its own statue, a 7.5-foot-tall bronze statue of Baphomet, a goat-headed creature with wings and an Iggy Pop-inspired human chest. In 2018, the group temporarily brought Baphomet to the state capitol on a forklift to protest what they argued was unequal treatment by the state. If the Ten Commandments could be displayed on government property, the group argued, then why not show off Baphomet too? A rally organizer explained, "If you're going to have one religious monument up, then it should be open to others. And if you don't agree with that, then let's just not have any at all." The Satanic Temple's offer to privately donate Baphomet was ultimately rejected, prompting it to join the ACLU of Arkansas in a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the Ten Commandments Monument Display Act. Tuesday's ruling by District Judge Christine G. Baker sided with the Satanic Temple, along with the American Humanist Association, the Freedom from Religion Freedom Foundation, and the Arkansas Society of Freethinkers. Baker ruled that the installation of the Ten Commandments monument conveys a message that the Christian religion is favored, and the Display Act is coercive in violation of the Establishment Clause. She also noted that the Satanic Temple was prevented from competing with Christianity on an equal footing for placement of its Baphomet monument on state capitol grounds, which meant the state had also violated the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. Baker's ruling orders Arkansas Secretary of State Cole Jester to remove the Ten Commandments statue immediately, but the order is on hold pending a potential appeal. Jester has already said that his team is working closely with the Attorney General's office to protect the critical part of the Capitol in the courts, reported the Arkansas Advocate. Former Arkansas State Senator Jason Rappert, Republican from Conway, who originally sponsored the monument, said the ruling during Holy Week was a slap in the face to Jews and Christians. He vowed that he, along with the National Association of Christian Lawmakers, would continue to fight the ruling. For now, the Satanic Temple is celebrating the win. The group's website says the case will have reverberations far and wide, validating the fundamental strength of our arguments and mission. The Baphomet saga is just one of the ways the Satanic Temple has sought to defend pluralism and challenge Christian hegemony in America. The temple first garnered national attention in 2013 for trolling former Florida Republican Governor Rick Scott over his support for prayer in Florida's public schools. The same year, temple members held a pink mass to criticize Westboro Baptist Church leader Fred Phelps. In the made-up ritual, same-sex couples kissed over the grave of Phelps's mother, which the Satanic Temple claimed would turn Phelps's mother gay in the afterlife. In 2014, members attempted to host a black mass at Harvard University, which prompted protests by outraged Catholic groups. In 2019, Penny Lane, the director of Hail Satan, which chronicles the Satanic Temple's many media stunts, told Reason that despite being founded as a prank, the Satanic Temple has very quickly gained a huge amount of authentic followers. "They're not going to stop," Lane said. "I think most politicians are just kind of like, if we wait this out, they'll go away. And I'm telling you, they're not going away." Tuesday's decision seems to confirm Lane's prediction. Review. Church committee report on illegal spying is relevant again in the Trump era. It's not a good sign when a 50-year-old Senate committee report on illegal government activities is relevant and timely enough for a new release. The Church Committee report, revelations from the bombshell 1970s investigation into the national security state, has, alas, arrived at the right political moment. This new, abridged version of the infamous 1976 report appears as the Trump administration pursues retaliatory investigations into political opponents and so-called domestic terrorists. The committee, chaired by Senator Frank Church, Democrat from Idaho, was formed after Watergate to answer basic questions about domestic surveillance. Who was the government spying on? How was it spying? What was it doing with the information? And was it following the law? The answer to each of these questions is disturbing, the report concluded. Too many people have been spied upon by too many government agencies, and too much information has been collected. The government has often undertaken the secret surveillance of citizens on the basis of their political beliefs, even when those beliefs posed no threat of violence or illegal acts on behalf of a hostile foreign power. The report aired some of the FBI and CIA's dirtiest laundry, including illegal wiretapping, unethical medical experiments, and covert programs to disrupt lawful political organizing. As the editors of the new edition, the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Matthew Guarulhia and Georgetown's Brian Hockman write in their preface, no government document has done more to expose the mechanisms behind America's aspirations of political supremacy in the 20th century. Guarulhia and Hockman have stripped the 3,100-page report down to its core revelations, along with case studies on such scandals as the FBI's blackmail operation against Martin Luther King Jr. This new edition will be an eye-opener for anyone who's not paranoid enough yet. Birthright Citizenship, Gnome Family Circus, and Project Hail Mary. You are paying for retirees' lavish lifestyles. As he celebrated the 50th anniversary of Social Security, then Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill, Democrat from Massachusetts, hailed the program's epic accomplishments. In the days before Social Security was born, O'Neill said, life for the elderly is filled with uncertainty, dependency, and horror. When you get old, you are without income, without hope. The federal government's payments to retirees, he continued, meant that Americans no longer had to live in fear and dependency in old age. It was a tidy summary of the conventional wisdom surrounding America's old age entitlement state, which includes not just Social Security, but also Medicare and many other taxpayer-funded efforts to subsidize the supposedly nasty, brutish, and not-so-short lives of the over-65 crowd. It is a narrative that deserves to be shoved off a cliff. Today's retirees, most of them from the baby boomer generation, are the wealthiest cohort of Americans. The median household headed by someone over age 65 is far wealthier than the average household headed by someone in their late 30s. Despite that, roughly 22 cents of every dollar the federal government spent last year was funneled to retirees via Social Security. Medicare spending accounted for another 14%. Many of those dollars were extracted from younger, poorer Americans. The rest were borrowed and added to the national debt. A retired couple today might possess a robust retirement account and own a million-dollar home, but the government still acts as if they live in the poverty-stricken hellscape that O'Neill described. As the old have gotten wealthier, the taxpayer-funded benefits have only gotten more lavish. Social Security provides inflation-proof monthly payments, keeping retirees ahead of the curve even as working-age Americans struggle to make ends meet. In many places, seniors are gifted special exemptions from taxes on homes and vehicles that aren't available to younger Americans. Medicare, created to address seniors' medical needs, now offers such taxpayer-funded perks as discounted golf course fees, ski resort lift tickets, even pet supplies and pickleball equipment. In short, today's old-age entitlement system is not a last-resort guardrail against poverty and desolation. It is a sprawling, expensive lifestyle subsidy program that steals from the poor to give to the rich, while also worsening the housing crisis and pushing the country toward a dangerous fiscal cliff. It's one thing to believe that we have a moral, political, or economic imperative to protect the elderly from falling into poverty. But does that mean we should risk the future of the United States to pay for their vacations and their pets' flea shampoo, too? San Diego County, California, is one of the wealthiest parts of America. Its population of 3.3 million boasts more than 100 millionaire households and 100,000 millionaire households, and a total economic output higher than that of Greece. And when the retired denizens of San Diego County hit the links for an afternoon, poorer taxpayers working in a far less desirable parts of the country helped to pick up the tab. That's because retirees in Southern California who have enrolled in Clever Care's Medicare Advantage program get reduced greens fees at the Oceanside Golf Course and five other courses in the area. Those types of health and wellness benefits have become increasingly common under Medicare Advantage, which was created in 1997 as an alternative to traditional Medicaid, but is still funded by federal payroll taxes. A provision tucked into a 2018 budget bill loosened the rules for those supplemental benefits to allow Medicare Advantage plans to offer any perks with a reasonable expectation of improving or maintaining the health or overall function of enrollees. Those supplementary benefits are available to anyone who has a chronic health condition, which isn't much of a barrier since 95% of the Medicare population qualifies. Those benefits often include services that have basically nothing to do with healthcare. Things like transportation services, grocery discounts, pest control, and a wide range of non-fitness social club memberships, according to a 2019 memo published by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. One Medicare Advantage plan available through Aetna advertises discounts for pickleball fees, golf green fees, ski lift passes and fees, bowling, yoga, stretching, dance classes, and more. A plan offered by Humana promises coverage for pet food, pet toys, kitty litter, and flea shampoo. More than 400 Medicare Advantage plans offered to pay for pet services in 2024, according to a survey by ATI Advisory, a research firm that tracks healthcare plans' offerings. More than 170 plans offered coverage for barbering and beauty services, while 137 offered travel services. In all, ATI estimates that more than 10 million older Americans had access to a Medicare Advantage plan that offered non-medical supplemental benefits. All of that comes at a tremendous cost to taxpayers. Though it is operated by private companies rather than the federal government, Medicare Advantage is funded by payroll taxes. The exact tally of the costs is difficult to pin down. In 2022, those supplemental benefits offered by Medicare Advantage plans cost $6.4 billion, according to a 2023 Government Accountability Office report. But, as the auditors noted in that study, there was little awareness about how the money was actually being spent, as CMS did not have a work plan or timeline for determining whether those extra goodies actually support the health and social needs of Medicare enrollees. Not all supplemental benefits are necessarily inappropriate, says Chris Pope, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, who has been calling out the wasteful perks in Medicare Advantage plans. In some cases, those benefits might produce cost savings relative to what the government would have to cover in the traditional fee-for-service Medicare model. However, Pope's research shows that those benefits are a growing burden for taxpayers. Between 2015 and 2024, the per-beneficiary cost of those supplemental benefits rose from $960 to more than $2,500. Medicare Advantage was created with the intention of reducing Medicare costs. Today, however, it is more expensive. In 2025, Medicare Advantage payments were 20% higher, which meant an extra $84 billion in costs, according to KFF, a think tank focused on healthcare policy. More than half of all eligible beneficiaries are now enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans, up from less than 20% two decades ago. The supplemental benefits are not the only reason why Medicare Advantage tends to cost more, but there's no doubt that they are a contributing factor. The overall trajectories are undeniable, too. Medicare is already the single largest driver of the national debt, and its spending growth is expected to outpace every other portion of the federal government over the coming decades. seniors today are getting more and better taxpayer-funded benefits than ever before, all paid for with tax dollars and huge amounts of borrowing. Given those trends, the supplemental benefit cost would be worth scrutinizing even if Medicare were on a solid fiscal footing. As it is, taxpayers are paying for golf outings and pet shampoo while the program, and with it the federal government, is speeding toward a fiscal brick wall. If older Americans weren't getting discounts on lift tickets and pet shampoo, they'd probably be just fine. Most of them would still be far wealthier than the working-age Americans still paying into the system. This is the absurd reality of America's old-age entitlement state in the mid-2020s. The median household headed by someone over age 65 had a net worth of more than $400,000 in 2022, according to Federal Reserve data. For those under age 35, that figure was just $39,000. If anything, that statistic actually underestimates the wealth gap that has opened up between the baby boomers and everyone else. Research by the New York University economist Edward Wolff shows that the inflation-adjusted average net worth of a person in the 65 to 74 age range has increased 178% since 1989. Wolff concludes that individuals who bought stocks and homes in the 1980s, that is to say baby boomers, were uniquely well-positioned to take advantage of rising asset prices and home values. Measures of retired households' net worths also fail to take into account the future value of Social Security payments, which in some cases can be quite lucrative. The maximum Social Security benefit this year is more than $5,000 per month, which means that a high-earning couple could easily qualify for more than six figures in annual Social Security benefits. This is a good opportunity to confront an objection that always gets raised when Social Security is discussed. No, today's seniors are not merely getting back what they paid into the system during their working years. The average dual-income earning retiree household in 2025 will receive 32% more in Social Security and Medicare benefits than the payroll taxes they contributed over their lifetimes, according to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Single-income households come out even farther ahead, collecting on average over 62% more in benefits than what they paid in taxes. That gap persists across all income levels. Retirees are also protected against inflation in ways that working-age Americans are not. Social Security benefits come with automatic cost-of-living adjustments that take rising prices into account. In 2023, retirees got an 8.7% boost in their benefits because of high inflation levels. It was one of the largest cost-of-living adjustments Social Security had ever delivered. Most workers did not get an 8.7% raise that year. America's old-age entitlement system may have been designed in times when old people were more likely to be destitute or face unaffordable health care costs. But today, the two major federal entitlement programs have become a reverse Robin Hood system that redistributes trillions of dollars from productive but relatively poor workers to unproductive, wealthy retirees. There are logical reasons for older Americans to be wealthier. They've had more time to save, invest, buy property, start businesses, and so on. It's a testament to the power of America's capitalist economy that the elderly today are more prosperous than ever, and that they are, by and large, not living in the fear and dependency that O'Neill once invoked. That is all good news. The problem is that government policy does not reflect this reality. Last year, two-thirds of federal entitlement spending was targeted at the 17% of Americans who are over 65. Medicare cost nearly $1 trillion, and Social Security redistributed $1.2 trillion to retirees. Social Security spending is particularly lopsided. Last year, only 7% of its benefits flowed to the poorest 20% of seniors, while the wealthiest 20% collected 29% of the payouts. Andrew Biggs, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and longtime advocate for Social Security reforms, says that statistic reinforces how far the program has drifted from its original goal of saving the elderly from living in destitution. Imagine proposing to create this system today from scratch. Would any Republican in Congress vote to drain the paychecks of manufacturing workers to subsidize retired Californians' golf habits? Would any Democrat want to tax younger, poorer people to pad the lifestyles of the already wealthy? Sadly, both major parties are focused on giving even more special treatment to wealthy, old Americans at the expense of everyone else. When Michigan Democrat Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced plans for a $90 million property tax break that would exclusively benefit senior citizens in her state, her administration promoted the proposal on social media. This is the sort of thing that states and local governments have been doing routinely for years, under the logic that older Americans need or deserve to pay lower taxes so they can afford to stay in their homes even after retirement. This time, however, the announcement backfired. The Democratic governor's post got ratioed on the social media app X, a term for the situation where a post gets more negative comments than likes. Many of the critics accused Whitmer of contributing to total boomer luxury communism, a term coined last year by Russ Green that has become a meme in wonkier corners of the internet, and even earned its own Wikipedia page. Green, executive director of the Prime Mover Institute, an energy policy think tank, defines total boomer luxury communism as a system of political economy that transfers wealth to older people at the expense of younger generations. It is a useful term encompassing everything from Social Security to special tax breaks for retirees. America has achieved the Marxist paradise of hunting in the morning, fishing in the afternoon, rearing cattle in the evening, and criticizing after dinner, Green wrote in a December essay for The American Mind. Only it looks like more like golf in the morning, horseback riding in the afternoon, drinks at the social club in the evening, and a restful night's sleep in a million-dollar home, all thanks to the largesse of the U.S. government. Green is quick to point out that he's not an economist or an entitlement policy wonk. He works on energy policy. But he's capable of doing the math and noticing social trends, and his total boomer luxury communism label serves as both a criticism and a call to action. He wants younger Americans to recognize that the old age entitlement state is not just stealing a chunk of their paychecks, it's taking away opportunities. Tax breaks for senior citizens, like the one Whitmer proposed earlier this year, are the perfect example. Many states have some sort of property tax relief program for senior citizens. Like Social Security and Medicare, they may have been created with a good intention, to help older Americans make ends meet. In reality, however, these schemes have worsened the housing crisis in important ways. Special property tax breaks incentivize retirees to stay in their homes longer than they otherwise would. A 2024 survey from Freddie Mac found that nearly 70% of baby boomers, who accounted for 20% of the U.S. population, but 36% of all homeowners, plan to stay in their homes for the foreseeable future. That in turn reduces the number of homes on the market and likely nudges upward the price for homes that are available. At the same time, exempting or reducing a subset of homes from property taxes also never means the government spends less money. It means pushing the entire tax burden onto a smaller number of homeowners. In this case, all homeowners under age 65. That's fundamentally unfair for current homeowners, and it also pushes the overall cost of home ownership higher, potentially pricing out younger Americans who are hoping to buy. As with Social Security's cost of living adjustments and the special perks in Medicare, older Americans are collecting all the benefits of these tax policies, while younger, poorer Americans bear the costs. The expansion of total boomer luxury communism into the tax code has been a bipartisan effort. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, passed by Republicans in Congress and signed by Donald Trump this last year, included a provision giving senior citizens a new $6,000 deduction on their federal income taxes. That provision was included as a roundabout way of fulfilling Trump's 2024 campaign trail promise to end taxes on Social Security. As if adding insult to injury, Trump's Treasury Department has been marketing that change as a tax cut for working families. It is quite literally the opposite, as workers will continue to have money taken out of their paychecks to fund Social Security payments to seniors, who will exclusively benefit from the new carve-out. It's good to be a boomer. It bears repeating. Today's retirees are the wealthiest generation in U.S. history. That's not a criticism. The Americans born after World War II had greater educational opportunities than their parents, turned those degrees into successful careers, then parlayed that into sizable nest eggs. Their financial success is not something to envy, but to emulate. Baby boomers achieved financial independence, and everyone following in their wake should aspire to the same. The days when old people were without income, without hope, are hopefully gone for good. We should simply demand that government policy recognize that this reality and change to reflect it. The time to make changes is now, because Social Security and Medicare are both veering into insolvency. If nothing is done, Social Security benefits will be cut by an estimated 23% across the board in 2032, according to the program's trustees' most recent report. Because Medicare payments are more complicated, involving hospitals, other health care providers, pharmacies, and the like, that program's insolvency, which will also hit in the mid-2030s, will play out in less straightforward ways. When insolvency hits, Congress may reach for the easiest solution, borrowing even more heavily to keep those programs running. That outcome would compound how unfair the entitlement programs are, as additional borrowing could push inflation higher. In other words, workers would be getting taxed to pay for retirees' benefits, including inflation-proof adjustments, while the dollars they are allowed to keep have less value. As a matter of economics and logic, the status quo of America's old-age entitlement system is unsustainable and indefensible. Retirees are collecting more than they contributed, and that disconnect is contributing to a whole bunch of other problems, from rising debt to the housing crisis. But a lot of the inertia on this topic is bound up with a moral argument that retirees are, well, entitled to those benefits, and that any cuts are tantamount to breaking a promise. That social contract has already been broken. It was broken years ago, when politicians in D.C. decided to run up the federal debt to historically high levels, argues Green. What that means is that younger people, even people not born yet, are being forced to pay against their will for programs that don't benefit them. The most direct fix would be requiring Congress to include Social Security and Medicare in its annual budget process. As long as those programs run on autopilot as so-called mandatory spending, their problems are easier to ignore. If members of Congress had to vote every year on siphoning money from poor workers to pay wealthy retirees, that calculus might change. Would those finite tax dollars be better spent on other priorities? Would it be better if we didn't extract that cash from workers in the first place? Today, less than 7% of senior citizens are living below the poverty line. Reconstituting the entitlement state to help them, and others on the lower end of the income scale, should be possible without continuing to subsidize the lifestyles of the rich and elderly. In 2022, the Congressional Budget Office calculated that Social Security's insolvency could be fixed by giving all seniors a flat monthly payment equal to 150% of the federal poverty line, about $1,700 a month. That's not an ideal solution, as it wouldn't save workers from continuing to pay payroll taxes, but it would be a huge improvement over the status quo and would ensure seniors are kept out of poverty. If even that change is too ambitious for right now, it's still encouraging to see small attempts to curb total boomer luxury communism. In January, the Trump administration announced that it would be increasing payments to Medicare Advantage providers by just 0.09% this year, a huge drop from the 5% payment increase that those providers got last year, and well below other recent increases. That change sent some of the major providers scrambling to lobby for more money. If the administration sticks to its guns, that may help to temper insurers' push to get more seniors into Medicare Advantage, often by luring them with those outlandish perks. New rules issued by CMS limit some Medicare Advantage perks by blocking coverage for facelifts and other cosmetic surgeries, funeral costs, and alcohol, tobacco, and cannabis products. The fact that Medicare was apparently paying for booze and smokes in the first place should say a lot about how few restrictions there are on Medicare Advantage perks. The administration is also considering changes that will increase reporting from insurers about how those supplemental benefits are being used. Pope believes those changes will curb some of the excessive spending on frivolous things, such as pet shampoo and haircuts. That said, there hasn't been a structural change to the rules governing the supplemental benefits for the chronically ill, he adds. There certainly hasn't been any direct move to eliminate ski or golf benefits. The moral argument that the government should tax young people to pay for such benefits is bunk. Today, it is not the old, but the young who are facing the terrifying uncertainty of a fiscal crisis, one brought on by the federal government's insistence that wealthy old people have a categorical right to welfare. It is one thing to support those in need. Everyone else should pay for their own damn golf outings. The new forever war in Iran keeps the dog wagging. At press time, the U.S. is engaged in a war with Iran, or at least very warlike behavior, including taking out much of a sitting government, killing Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and several top military commanders, dropping 2,000-pound bombs from B-2 stealth bombers on missile and nuclear facilities, and launching Tomahawk cruise missiles and drones at hundreds of targets across the country. Why? That depends on whom you ask and on which day. Perhaps there was an imminent threat, maybe even a nuclear threat, to the United States. Or perhaps the Iranian regime is a sponsor of terror, on which we have already declared war. Or perhaps we need to support our allies in the region. Or perhaps just because Khamenei was just a world-historically murderous bastard, even in a region famed for its murderous bastards. Here's a good rule of thumb, both for understanding foreign policy and also for life in general. When someone offers a bunch of rapid-fire and mutually irreconcilable justifications for a controversial decision, they're not telling you the full story. William Shakespeare might have invoked letting slip the dogs of war to describe the unleashing of violence, but these days we just wag the dog. Popularized by Our American Cousin, the play being performed at Ford's Theater when President Abraham Lincoln was shot, the phrase took on an explicitly political meaning after the ripped from the headlines 1997 film Wag the Dog. In that otherwise pretty awful movie, a fabricated military conflict was used to distract voters from a presidential sex scandal. Since then, the term has become shorthand for the idea that leaders sometimes use military action to divert attention from problems at home. A wag-the-dog allegation need not mean the reasons for war are made up from whole cloth. Real geopolitical tensions, real strategic dilemmas, and real threats obviously exist. But the utility of a foreign conflict as a tool for domestic political positioning, especially when electoral outcomes are looking shaky, is a recurring theme in American history. Trump's approval ratings are notably terrible. National polling aggregates suggest his job approval stands somewhere near 40%. A president facing a highly competitive election year and significant scrutiny on issues ranging from the economy to the ongoing incredulity and disappointment about the release of the Epstein files might well cast about for a distraction. The war also doesn't necessarily have to be popular to accomplish some doggish goals. Though reporting suggests that President Trump believed Americans in general, and his MAGA supporters more specifically, would rally around the war, a Reuters Ipsos survey shows only about 27% of the country approving of the strikes on Iran, while 43% disapprove and many are uncertain. A larger poll conducted by the University of Maryland before the attacks suggested that even fewer Americans support a U.S. attack on Iran under current circumstances, as low as around 21%. The two Trump terms have dramatically shortened the public's attention span. After a strike on Iran in June, which the administration declared a total success in eliminating Iran's nuclear capability, the president might have hoped for a polling bump, some strange new respect from the more hawkish Republicans on the Hill, or at least a few more days of coverage. But that episode quickly faded from view and didn't resolve any of the underlying problems in the region. But Americans didn't seem to hate it either, so the temptation emerged to try again. Even when wars are unpopular or divisive, they command attention and can reframe political discourse away from domestic grievances and toward questions of national security. A war does not need majority support to serve this function. It needs only to be salient enough to shift the conversation. Even days of online dunking and pushback on Trump's inconsistencies on war with Iran can have a kind of invigorating effect. And at least the topic has some gravitas, unlike the slow-moving Epstein disaster or the dismal economic data constantly trickling out. Trump ran as an opponent of forever wars, and he won over at least some voters with that emphasis. Those voters, and perhaps more importantly, increasingly fractious GOP influencers such as Tucker Carlson and Megyn Kelly, are justifiably angry. Democratic politicians and voters are, of course, more than happy to pick holes in the confused and confusing justifications for a war launched without respect for Congress or the opinions of the American people. Too little, too late, Congress has creaked into slow action to hint at protecting its privileges to wage war. Once military action begins, it becomes easier for leaders to justify extensions, surges, and escalations without ever obtaining the degree of popular backing that a war with clear goals, or a thoughtful peace, might command. The current conflict with Iran, unlike the fictional war in Wag the Dog, is rooted in decades of geopolitical friction, sanctions, proxy battles, and strategic competition. Many Iranians, at least in these early days, have reacted with joy to American bombings. But it remains true that when foreign policy is conducted in the service of domestic politics, wars become tempting as tools of distraction, puffery, and electoral signaling. Perhaps the many competing explanations offered for this war each capture some part of the truth. But when the list grows long and the emphasis keeps shifting, that often means the conflict is doing more than one job. And wars that do multiple jobs for the people waging them, military, diplomatic, electoral, are the ones most likely to stick around forever. Welfare on wheels, the truth about the supposed truck driver shortage. A small logging contractor in upstate New York had a truck empty and needed someone with experience, and I needed a job. At that point, I'd been trucking for nearly 20 years in four different counties, countries, and had done a fair bit of logging. It seemed like a natural pairing, and when I went to meet the man behind this small outfit, we'll call him Travis, he expressed optimism. "I think you'll like this old Kenworth we've got here," said Travis. "My uncle was driving it until he got sick, and we've had a hell of a time finding a decent driver for it. The last two clowns we had didn't work out. One guy wouldn't show up for work every day. I think he might have been a method. And the other guy kept running into stuff and breaking things." The unit happened to have a load on it, and I offered to run it to whatever mill the wood was bound for. "Now, let's go for a little drive around the neighborhood with it on. I can't take it anywhere yet, but it will work for now to let me see how you handle a load." So away we went, driving along, moving through the gears with the grace and oneness with the machine I had developed over two decades of driving. I discussed with Travis my experiences, the difference between the United States, Australia, and my original home of Canada, and the nuances of harvesting softwood lumber in New Zealand versus harvesting the hardwoods most of the Northeast U.S. is known for. After a while, we returned to his yard and parked the truck. "When should I book you for a P-test?" asked Travis. "I mean, I can go whenever you like. We haven't discussed any other terms or money or anything, though. I'll have a discussion with my business partner about that this evening, and in the meantime, I can get you in for a urine test tomorrow morning. Sound good?" I agreed and left it at that. The next day, as I was heading to a clinic to produce a sample, my phone rang. It was Travis. "My partner and I have decided we can start you at $14 an hour and revisit this number in the new year." It took me quite a bit of restraint to not burst out laughing. No offense, sir, but that's not enough. I'm making $16 an hour cash under the table now, helping my contractor buddy schlep gear and run a chop box. I have to be able to at least move laterally, not backward." "Well, what did you expect? You're just a truck driver. We can revisit in the new year, but I can't pay you more than $14. "Sir, with all due respect, I just got back from driving road trains in Australia, and I was being paid $42 an hour down there. I have 20 years of experience, and that has to count for something." "You could have been making all of that up." Despite sending this guy a full list of references, emails, and phone numbers of previous employers, and photos of rigs I had driven. This was the offer I got to work at one of the most dangerous and economically critical jobs in the country. It was less than the fight for $15 minimum wage envisioned by my Bernie-supporting in-laws. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Well, thanks anyway, and now you know why the last two guys you had didn't work out. $14 an hour doesn't buy what you want it to buy. Good luck. This gentleman wasn't an anomaly. A local gravel quarry that had its own dump trucks and flatbeds for local work was also advertising for drivers. I went to see them, did the drive with one of their old boys, and a few days later got a call. Hi there. So we are prepared to offer you $18 an hour as our special summer seasonal rate. But if you stick around and go full-time in the fall, that drops to $15. Again, I had to fight back laughter. Ma'am, it's awfully difficult to raise a family on the money you guys are offering. It is what it is. We usually hire old guys who are retired from driving snowplows or construction for the county. Something about my experiences here didn't make sense. For years, we have been told that the American economy is at risk of total collapse if the American trucking associations can't find another 60 or 70,000 or 160,000 drivers. If there are actual shortages of truckers, trucking companies wouldn't get away with barely paying minimum wage. Now, would they? If the market for drivers were this hot and this desperate, maybe a guy with two decades of experience and a near-perfect driving record would get offers more befitting his profile. In a properly functioning market economy, wouldn't the shortage boost the price of truckers' labor a little higher than what one might expect at a fast food restaurant? What are we missing here? After the Motor Carrier Act of 1980, under the pressure of increased competition, companies sliced driver salaries as a belt-tightening strategy. Many drivers chose greener pastures as a result, and for a brief period in the 1980s, there may actually have been a shortage of truckers. But now? The ATA is a corporate lobby that claims to represent the interests of massive trucking companies with thousands of trucks. It really represents the interests of the customers of those large carriers, nearly every corporation in America that produces material product. The ATA does not represent a single truck driver anywhere. When the ATA hit on that phrase, truck driver shortage, it found a messaging tool that has helped them line their pockets with oodles of taxpayer money. In the process, it stymied wage growth to the advantage of trucking fleet owners and the Fortune 500 companies that are their customers. And this has been readings from Reason Magazine, issue April 2026, read to you by Steve Malisi. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.